Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 10. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. In this episode, I'll be interviewing Rick Doblin, Ph.D. from MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. This is a great interview, and Rick was a really cool guy to interview with, so stay tuned. This is a great interview. Thanks to those who made it to the presentation at the Living Temple this weekend. I was able to meet a couple listeners there, and I may try to get the video of the presentation online this week if time permits. Donations, thanks to Dubfront and Matthew, as well as Professor John Rush for their kind and generous donations. This is the second donation that I've received from Matthew, and I really appreciate it. Dubfront answered my request to please donate whatever you can, large or small. A huge thanks for that. Every bit helps, and I really appreciate it. All of you are what keep the show going. And I'm not asking that you donate a lot, but whatever you can. The show is now in its 10th week, getting about 21,000 listens per month. Thanks to the donations, I was able to pay for a decent bandwidth package that I hope will last for a few months, which I'm already over 50% usage on the new package. So who knows how long it'll last, but hopefully at least for a little while. Even if 20% of you donate a dollar a week, that would help facilitate some really cool video and podcast projects, as I've mentioned before. And I hate to keep asking for donations, but I still need camera equipment if anyone can help with that. Since someone came through on the recording equipment, I know it's possible to happen with video equipment, so I guess I'll just keep asking and hope that someone can come through on that. If you would like more information regarding my video project, please feel free to contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And the show is free of charge, listener-sponsored. It's not corporate media, so you decide what you want to listen to instead of the corporations. And there is quite a lot of cost and time involved in doing these shows, so please help with whatever you can. I don't get rich from the book sales on the website, and so when you buy a book from the website versus buying one from Amazon, you're helping fund this podcast as well as several other projects that are in the works. So please buy a book or DVD or donate whatever you can. Your help is needed and greatly appreciated. The Holy Mushroom, my new book, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity. I still have about 16 copies of the numbered and signed available. Thank you to those who have purchased a copy from the website. You can get it for about $9 or $10 cheaper on Amazon.com if you cannot afford to buy it from the website. I totally understand that. Times are tough right now. But if you go to the Gnostic Media website and click on the Amazon.com button from there, you'll still help. I get a dollar to from each purchase that you make. If you buy my book or other books through the Gnostic Media link to Amazon on the website, so that is also very helpful. Let's see, what else do we have here? There are Also, t-shirts and Christmas cards and things like that that you can buy on the Cafe Press link on the website. I haven't mentioned that before, but that is also on the website. It's been up there for probably a couple years. There are also audio archives available through Gnostic Media, which are the She Who Remembers audio archives. It's about 500 hours worth of audio by Jeannie Brittingham Erstad, who died in 2002. There's probably 60 or 70 hours worth of Terence McKenna talks in there, as well as a lot of other good material. You can find the link to the SWR archives on the bottom right of the Gnostic Media website. I will be moving that. That will go to a different website of mine. And soon I will be moving that over to the Gnostic Media website and putting a better link there. And for those of you who have not seen the documentary that I did with Andrew Rutaji called The Pharmacratic Inquisition, please go to the website. You can watch the video there for free. And since this is the Christmas season, I think you and your family may appreciate some of the content about the origins of Christmas that are in the DVD. The DVD is also available for purchase on the website if you would like to own a copy. And once again, regarding the microphone issues, I apologize for any inconveniences. This is the second to the last show that was recorded with the cheap microphone. So once the interview gets started, there is some static from the other microphone. With David's donation, which is hooked up now and in use, we shouldn't have any more problems with my microphone and audio quality from now on. The last interview that I used the bad microphone on is with Dr. Stanislav Grof. So my interview with Roland Griffiths coming up after that will be recorded on the new microphone and is in much better quality. Speaking of upcoming shows, I've got several shows already recorded. I recorded one with former U.S. Justice Department prosecutor John Loftus, J.D., which is a doctor of law. And he is discussing the Bush family's corruption and connections with the Nazis and Muslim Brotherhood. I had intended to release that with the DeMeo interview, but due to the exceeding length of that interview, I decided not to put it on the end of that, and I may release it on as its own show, or append it to another one, or possibly maybe a special midweek release or something like that. I haven't exactly figured out where I'll put it. It is a short interview at 30 minutes. I may put an article that I did on the definition of liberal along with that release. I may read that for the audience. It's an article that I wrote about 10 years ago that discusses exactly what is a liberal, etc. Also coming up December 29th, I interview John Lamb Lash on the Gnostics. January 5th, Dr. Stanislav Grof regarding LSD research, synchronicity, holotropic breathing techniques, etc. January 12th, I have Dr. Roland Griffiths on. That is a fantastic interview. Again, a very excellent guest. I've also recorded with Chris Bennett, who is the author of Green Gold, The Tree of Life, as well as Sex, Drugs, Violence, and the Bible, regarding his studies into cannabis and other drugs involved in Christianity and other religions. And Steve Booner, I still have not found time to record my interview with him. He's got a very small window of time available to reach him, so I'll get that done as soon as possible. Also upcoming but not scheduled is Professor Michael Winkelman from Arizona State. He will be coming on to discuss his new book, Supernatural as Natural, A Bicultural Approach to Religion. And also coming up probably early February will be Dr. Dennis McKenna, the brother of Terence McKenna. And also I will be interviewing Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of the famed Dead Sea Scrolls scholar John Marco Allegro. She is author of John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and will be on the show to discuss the upcoming re-release of John Marco Allegro's book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And I myself have worked with Judy for 4 years now, and I'm really excited to have her on the show. Judy has been pivotal in the writing of my own books, and So I'm excited about that. And I'll also be playing an interview from the 1980s with John Allegro that Judy provided me a couple of years ago. Before this interview, there were no known recordings of Allegro in existence. And now there are a few available, so I will be playing at least one of those on the show. If you would like to contact me directly, feel free to contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Please also check out the website and forums at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. And you can check out the links page and you'll see some of the other projects on there. So we're going to jump in with Rick Doblin. Enjoy the show.
I'm here with Rick Doblin, PhD. Rick is the founder and president of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which he founded in 1986. His dissertation in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government was on the regulation of medical use of psychedelics and marijuana, and his master's thesis, also at Harvard, focused on the attitudes and experiences of oncologists concerning medical use of marijuana. His undergraduate thesis at the New College of Florida was a 25-year follow-up to the classic Good Friday experiment, which he evaluated the potential of psychedelic drugs to catalyze religious experiences. He has also conducted a 34-year follow-up study to Tim Leary's Concord Prison Experiment. Doblin has also studied with Stan Grof, MD, and was in the first group to become certified as holotropic breathwork practitioners. His professional goal is to help develop legal context for the beneficial uses of psychedelics and marijuana, primarily prescription medications, but also for personal growth for otherwise healthy people, and to also become a legally licensed psychedelic therapist. He currently resides in Boston with his wife and three young children. Rick, welcome aboard.
Wow, thank you very much. Quite an introduction. It makes me tired thinking of all those things I want to do.
it's awesome background you've got there. Congratulations.
Well, I shouldn't say tired. Tired and inspired.
Tired. Well, your work has been an inspiration to myself and many others, so we really appreciate what you do, and I appreciate you coming on my show.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, could you tell me a little bit about your background?
Yeah, I think the arc of my life, I'm now about to be 55, was... my childhood was really born in 1953. My childhood was primarily colored by the Holocaust. Jewish, and have relatives that some of them distant relatives that didn't make it out of Russian Poland and ended up getting killed. But it just made it clear to me that psychological factors, society's going crazy, that the deep unconscious, the people's ability to be manipulated on their emotions by leaders, that was the key danger to my life. And I also saw that as not just being unique to Jews, but that in many, many different ways there was this whole process of scapegoating, of people denying the shadow and projecting it outward. And it felt like that process was so potentially world destructive that I somehow wanted to work on that. I didn't know what that meant or how or anything like that, but that was sort of the primary influence. And I also, though, grew up in the context of somewhat conventionality, and I ended up really believing the anti-drug education that I got as a teenager in the early 60s. I thought LSD made you crazy in some deeply important way, and I really wasn't much of a emotional person. I was just very intellectual, not that I'm trying to say I'm smart, but just that I was very thoughtful rather than feeling. And then there was this transformation part where in order to respond to the Vietnam War, to the draft, to the lottery, to various things like that, I felt like there was a similar process of scapegoating going on, this whole dividing the world into black and white, communist and free, and not that I would have wanted to grow up in a communist country, but that I felt like what was going on in Vietnam was not really essential for Americans for freedom, but that I thought it was a more of a civil war that we were foolishly involved in. And so I ended up being a draft resister and expected to go to jail, expected to be, as Martin Luther King talked about it, people who had a great respect for the law were willing to break the law and then become an example to others, suffer the consequences and become an example to others. So I sort of, in this first sort of 17 years of my life, I ended up defining myself and making choices that put me at odds with my culture and was heading me towards jail. Still now, this is, you know, drugs are not involved in my life in any way. But then when I went to college, it turned out that the choice that I made about how to be a draft resister had unintendedly positive consequences. I really thought that in order to drain the maximum amount of energy from the war system, that I wanted to look at the different ways in which I and others would sort of grant it credibility or power. And it seemed like the most important first step was that you register for the draft, and then you decide whether the system will grant you status as a conscientious objector. So I'm not against all wars. I certainly think that pacifism in the face of Hitler would be certain death, and I did not feel like that was an appropriate response. So I'm not a conscientious objector. But this not registering, making them come after me, was the way to drain the energy from the system the most. And it turns out like 60,000 people had the same idea, and the system just did nothing. So there was no consequences whatsoever. So I was at college and waiting for the shoe to drop. I didn't know at the time that nothing was going to happen. But I happened to go to a college, the Honors College of the State of Florida now, New College of Florida. At the time it was a private school, heavy emphasis on independent study, on excellence in academics, on everybody had to do a senior thesis, and it was an experimental college where there was no grades. It was all written evaluations, and the principle was that the student's curiosity is the most important thing, and you need to follow your curiosity, and that's how you'll do the best work, and the school is set up for that. It was fantastic. Now, what they did not say in the admissions brochure was that it was a nudist colony at the pool. The school was in Florida, Sarasota. One of the professors who had actually studied with Carl Jung had donated a big outdoor swimming pool with a big fence around it, and it was a nudist colony. And I was like, wow, this is fantastic. Having been a shy guy in high school, I was particularly appreciative of it. The other thing that they didn't say was that there was this tradition of all-night dances under the stars, balmy Florida nights, with a tradition of people doing psychedelics. I'm like, this is very interesting. And I had by this time started questioning what I had learned about drugs. I had come to see that a lot of the propaganda about drugs was just that, propaganda. So I decided to try LSD. And it turned out to be more than I had anticipated. My bar mitzvah had failed to turn me into a man. I had believed that it would. But the psychedelics offered the potential of doing that. It really hit those deep kind of psychological factors. And it was the challenge, a major psychological challenge, a way to show courage and show growth. And I felt like LSD was this sort of rite of passage tool. But I took a bunch of it, and it was a little bit too much because I really didn't have the emotional capacity to handle it. And so I ended up going to one of the counselors at school. And he was sympathetic. And not only that, but he gave me a copy, a manuscript copy of Realms of the Human Unconscious by Stan Grof. And when I read that book, it was like my life sort of started coming together, what I wanted to do. This was a way that science, I really respected science, as do most people in our culture, and here was a scientific way to look at questions of religion and to try to test it so that it wasn't abstract, testing it by seeing if in a therapeutic context it could really help people. So that it wasn't just abstract philosophy, it was a way to take science into the deepest parts of the human mind and spirit and emotions with a practical test of are people getting better, but it addressed questions of religion and spirituality and values, and it offered what seemed to me to be the key entrance to the mystical experience, the sense of collectiveness, the sense of we're all in it together, that provided the antidote to fundamentalism and provided a way to have people appreciate differences rather than be scared by differences, and provided a bridge to talk to people who were different than you. In order to learn about the other, I had studied Russian in high school, and I'd gone to Russia. I'd spent a summer in Russia after my junior year of high school, and you know, it was very eye-opening to sort of see that the Russians were people too, that their government sucked and was really not appreciated much by the Russian people either. And so that our quarrel was not so much with all of the Russians are evil, but, you know, they had a bad system, and the Russian people were humans. You know, so breaking down this who the other is had started happening for me at an earlier age, but here it was, this sense of connection, this sense of unity, this mystical sense of our commonality seemed to me to be, if more people could feel that, that we would end up negotiating rather than killing, and listening rather than rejecting. And so it all said to me, okay, now, and this was 1971 and 72, so I'm waking up to psychedelics just as they're being shut down. The research was being squashed all over the world. It had already started to be crimped in the late 60s, but by 71 it was ended all over the world as this counter-reaction against sort of the psychedelic 60s. In part because people like the Beatles and others really did have this sense that their psychedelic experiences offered this sense of connection and that they were inspired by these psychedelic experiences to work towards social justice. So I looked around and I thought, okay, I'm going to be going to jail for my draft resistance. I'm not going to be able to get a license as a doctor or a lawyer or an Indian chief or anything like that. So I might as well try to bring this interest in psychedelics forward. And I thought, okay, I will become an underground psychedelic therapist. So that was my decision at 18. And since then, I should mention that President Carter, the first day of office in 1976, pardoned all the draft resistors. So that my arc has been to initially see myself as this sort of underground criminal psychedelic therapist, to wanting to bring to the culture, to be accepted, to bring to the mainstream this work, this research, and also this therapy, and my own self, so that I no longer think of myself as a counterculture person or a criminal or anything like that. I want to be, accepted, and I want these drugs to be accepted as mainstream. And, you know, I have a wife, I have kids, I have a station wagon, I have a picket fence, I live in suburbia. I'd like a picture of mainstream conventionality in a lot of ways. And I hope that psychedelics will make that transition as well. And if you look historically over the thousands of years that psychedelics have been used by different cultures, more often than not, they are accepted, honored, revered, ritualized, and form an important part of the culture. We're a cultural anomaly in that, you know, the Western mind has had a lot of suspicion about emotions and irrationality and religion, two great cause, actually, and we've accomplished an enormous amount. But we have sort of lost the spiritual core in a lot of ways, and in general, people are way overdeveloped intellectually and way underdeveloped emotionally, so that we cannot handle the technologies that we have. We're destroying the planet in all these different ways, and species are going extinct, and global warming, and warfares, and nuclear weapons, and everything, so that we are really in need of more balanced, me as individual, and society as well, and that's where I think psychedelics play a role in helping people to integrate the sort of raw passions and emotions and refine them so that we can come more in balance with our intellectual capabilities so that we can handle the technologies that we have and use them to enhance life rather than destroy life. So that I ended up, you know, as you noted, getting a PhD, a master's and a PhD from Harvard, from the Kennedy School of Government, and much of what I do now is under government approval from the DEA and the FDA and regulatory agencies around the world. And so, you know, my goal is to make psychedelics boring and accepted as just another thing, another option for people. You know, it's not really boring, but the idea is that it isn't inherently countercultural. I think that's what a lot of people sort of think, is that somehow or other psychedelics are all, this is Terrence McKenna talked a lot about it, that psychedelics are somehow inherently corrosive of the status quo. And there's a definite truth to that, but there are societies that have been able to incorporate criticism, the leading edge, in a way that orthodoxies don't do that well. So I think that, you know, we could even say that the election of Barack Obama is another great example of how our society has sort of been able to incorporate all these voices of how we need a new direction into the core of the society without a violent revolution, and that we are able to be a stronger society because of it. So I think that it's possible for psychedelics to be both bringing people into confrontation and acceptance of their shadows, into challenging the status quo, but without them being rejected by the culture and squashed and criminalized. And that's our challenge. And I think that 40 years from the 41 years now for the Summer of Love, from the hippies, from, you know, the psychedelic 60s, that our culture is much better prepared now in many different ways for the psychedelics and for this more spiritual approach to life. And I think time is on our side. We have a great opportunity. And MAPS, which is a, you know, small nonprofit, less than 2,000 members, been going on for 22 years, we're basically a nonprofit psychedelic and medical marijuana pharmaceutical company whose mission is to make these drugs into prescription medicines and to educate the public honestly about the risks and benefits, and eventually to help establish a network of psychedelic clinics where these substances would be used in productive ways for beneficial uses. And there, you know, there are parallel efforts to sort of focus on religious freedom in terms of access to these drugs in that way. I think that's very important. There's opportunities, lots of people working to try to talk about the drug war itself as being very counterproductive and how we really need to treat drug problems as a public health rather than a criminal justice issue. And not that alcohol and tobacco are the great examples of how drugs should be regulated, but more on those lines than as the underground. We constantly are hearing about how, you know, illegal drug profits are tearing apart societies and causing enormous violence, and, you know, it makes you wondering, well, why don't we take the money away from the underground, give it to the government, and really try to bring a better approach And so I think that's where I'm at. MAPS is trying to do this work, and it's necessary to do in a nonprofit context.
My next question, wanted to ask you, how did you get the first study started?
Well, how did we get the first study started? Well, let's talk about what we mean by the first study. MAPS was started in 1986. I learned about MDMA in 1982 when it was still legal. And it was clear to me, I previously had not realized, so let me back up a little bit. So from 1971, 72 is where I first got into doing a lot of psychedelics. But then I went to the guidance counselor at school. They were a little bit too much for me to handle. And I ended up dropping out of college for 10 years. So there was a 10-year period between my first semester of college and my second semester. And I went back to the same college that I had dropped out of. During that 10 years, I had thought that the research had been squashed, the psychedelic movement had been crushed, the drugs were all criminalized, and all that was left was these books. So, and the underground distribution of these drugs. So for this 10-year period, I would, every once in a while, doing little bits of LSD, reading a lot of these books, and believing that the whole psychedelic community had basically been squashed. And that was, tragic, except for the fact that there were some still, distribution of these drugs, mostly in recreational contexts. So when I started college 10 years later in 88, and I was able to start by doing a seminar at Esalen Institute with Stan Grof, whose books on psychedelic research I had been most inspired by. And I went out to Esalen, and to my surprise, I learned two things. I learned about MDMA, which astonished me, that here was this drug that had been used in underground psychedelic psychotherapy since the middle 70s that I didn't even know existed. And also that there was a whole underground psychedelic psychotherapy community, and people were working with these drugs in their practices, psychiatrists and psychologists risking jail to do so, other people were using them, that there was this sort of underground. And yet, having woken up to psychedelics in 71, 72, just as everything was being squashed, it was clear to me that in 1982, when I learned about MDMA, that history was going to repeat itself, that we already had the Nancy Reagan just say no, the drug war increasing. So I felt like this was really a great opportunity to try to do something different this time around. And so several others and I, in 1984, started a nonprofit organization that the goal of it was to protect MDMA. And so your question was, how do we start the first study? So the first study was really in 1984. It was a secret study on the safety of MDMA, and it was kept secret because we realized that as soon as we would make it public, then the government would know more about MDMA, which we didn't think they knew that much about, in at least not the therapeutic use. They knew about its growing use as a recreational drug under the name of ecstasy, but we didn't want to talk about the therapeutic use or bring any more attention to it. So we did a secret study on the safety of MDMA in 84. So that was really the first study. How that started was that there was a conference at Esalen that Dick Price, one of the co-founders of Esalen, had organized. Terrence McKenna was there, and he was starting to talk about how drugs that were from plants were better than drugs that were from the laboratory. And they'd been used for thousands of years, and they had a track record of history, and that they were from nature. And that drugs from the laboratory were artificial, and we didn't know much about them, and they just were, they didn't have their own spirit, they didn't have the spirit of nature. And I'm like, I thought that was a little bit ridiculous, and we're sort of talking about MDMA, and he was like, oh, God, dangerous, dangerous. And I was like, well, let's prove it. Let's do a study. I'll, put some money towards a study. And Dick Price said he'd put some money towards a study. So that's what started it. And it was people who recognized that MDMA was something unique, something that had a lot to offer, something that was gentle, something that our society could probably accept and integrate way more easily than LSD or the classic psychedelics. And so that got me my first experience in research. That's around the time that I started working on the Good Friday experiment, as well as my New College thesis. We sued the DEA when they tried to make MDMA into a Schedule I drug that would prohibit all medical use. And that was something that was successful. We ended up winning the lawsuit against the DEA, but it was just a recommendation from a DEA administrative law judge to the head of the DEA that it be put in Schedule III and that therapists be continually have legal access to it, even though the non-medical use would be criminalized. However, the head of the DEA did not accept that recommendation and put it in Schedule I and said all uses are now illegal, even therapeutic uses. So that made me think the only route to really bring these substances back is through the FDA, through making them into a medicine, and that therefore MAPS was started as a nonprofit organization to work with psychedelics and marijuana. And then we started figuring out what else we could do in terms of studies. But through the 80s, every application, we had five different studies submitted to the FDA. Some from Harvard Medical School, from NIDA-funded researchers at UCSF, great studies. And they were all rejected. So what I recognized then is that the government has lost all credibility as far as the risks of drugs because they way exaggerate them, and they've lost all credibility about the benefits because they completely deny them. But that there was a tendency to sort of mirror, become the opposite of what you are running from, which is just as bad. So I didn't want to exaggerate the benefits and deny the risks. And I had, in my work, trying to sue the DEA, had come across the work of Dr. George Riccardi. He was the expert, supposedly, on MDMA neurotoxicity. And he'd done some research in rats with MDA that showed some serotonergic neurotoxicity, and that was used by the DEA to try to justify their emergency scheduling of MDMA in 85. So I felt like, all right, I can't do any research into the benefits. What I need to do is research into the risks and really try to figure it out. So I said, rats are a lot different than people, and monkeys are closer to people. So I went to Riccardi, and I said, you know, why don't you study monkeys? And he's like, well, we don't got any money for that. And I said, okay, you know, maybe we can donate some money to you to buy some monkeys, and we can get some better data. Now, a lot of people are not very sympathetic with animal research, but I felt like at the time that it was the only way and essential to move through these spheres. So our first study ever as MAPS was donating money to George Riccardi for primate studies into MDMA neurotoxicity. Then, you know, the findings were equivocal. The doses are now we know the doses are not, that he was using are not equivalent to the human doses. So then the question was, well, let's get beyond these animals. What about people? And at the time, this is in the middle to late 80s, there were no brain scans. The best way to assess supposed neurotoxicity of MDMA was to take spinal taps from ecstasy users and look at serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine metabolites in cerebrospinal fluid, and then try to extrapolate back to what that might mean for levels in the brain. So I was like, hey, that doesn't sound very much fun. But I volunteered to get a spinal tap, and I felt like I couldn't recruit other people unless I'd done it myself. So George gave me a spinal tap at Stanford, and that began our second study, really, which was the human study, the spinal tap study. And we eventually got over 30 people to get spinal taps. And those results were somewhat equivocal, hard to interpret. And all the time I was trying to do clinical studies in the therapeutic uses of MDMA, and those were all being rejected. It was not possible at this time to do psychedelic psychotherapy research. It had been shut down, as I said, in 71 all over the world and still hadn't opened up. So at the same time, from like 85 to 87, is when I did my work on the Good Friday Experiment follow-up study. And the beauty of that was that I didn't really need to give drugs to anybody. And in fact, it was better than giving drugs to people, because the initial study of the Good Friday Experiment, which was looking at the spiritual use of psychedelics, in the classic mystical literature, the key is the fruits test. You know, what are the fruits of the experience? And you only get that over time. So I was able to do long-term follow-ups, 25 years of people who were in the Good Friday Experiment, and it was great what I found out. So that was, and we can talk about it more at length later, but that was my first personal research that I ever did. And then something shifted at the FDA in 89. And 89, 90, the people in charge of psychedelic research shifted. And the new people that took over were interested in science over politics. They were willing to approve psychedelic research. Rick Strassman, who had been one of the people who tried to do MDMA research but been rejected, devised a protocol that was with DMT, and he though looked at it as a different kind of a thing. He said that DMT is in the brain, maybe it's linked to schizophrenia. You know, he wants to study how this psychedelic drug could possibly, you know, cause brain, you know, psychological problems. So he wasn't looking at benefits, he was looking at problems. And he got permission in 1990. And so I had met Charlie Grobe at this time, and we were trying to do studies with MDMA, with cancer patients, with anxiety, all rejected. And then in 1992 is when we got the hold on just a second. All right, I'm sorry. I got a million things happening here.
No problem. You're talking about Charlie Grobe and 20 something.
Okay, so Charlie Grobe and I had met, and we were trying to do an MDMA cancer study. And so we had this meeting at FDA where they basically said, they wanted to review their policy formally about psychedelics. And they convened a meeting of the NIDA animal researchers who had not had a meeting for 10 years, who'd done animal research with psychedelics. And then the day after, this was several days of that, and then they were going to have an FDA advisory committee meeting. And the FDA advisory committee meeting basically said, we need to treat psychedelics like any other drug. And if we do that, we're, you know, the hardest, most difficult regulatory agency in the world as far as drugs. We don't need special procedures, you know, put on us by DEA or the Drug Czar's office, but we'll just supply the most rigorous standards that we have, and we'll treat psychedelics like any other drug. And that's what the advisory committee recommended. The NIDA researchers said that their animal studies were becoming increasingly irrelevant, because unless you can link them to human studies, how do you know what they mean? So the decision was by the advisory committee to recommend the renewal of psychedelic research, but psychedelic research treated just like any other drug. So what the FDA then said to us is, we cannot let you start by looking at therapeutic uses. We have to let you start by what's called a phase one safety study, where, particularly a dose response phase one safety study, where you start with small doses to a few people, then you give more people higher doses, and then you characterize the effects of the drug psychologically and physiologically, and you determine, are they safe enough to use? And so that's a long answer to your question about what's the first study, because this is the study that I think you meant, the first FDA-approved study with a psychedelic drug. And it was designed as a dose-response safety study, began in 92, finished around 94, 95, and what it showed is that MDMA could be safely used in a clinical research context. that there was no evidence of brain damage or harm to these subjects who received just a few doses, despite the fact that George Riccardi and others had tried to claim that one dose was permanent brain damage of a serious sort. We disproved that, and that really then opened the doorway to further studies into the therapeutic use of MDMA and other psychedelics.
Excellent. That's quite a quite an adventure there. Could you tell me? I want to jump forward in time to our more current history. I heard you recently had a victory against the DEA regarding medical marijuana. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Yes. Our victory against the DEA is we won the battle, but we have not won the war. The interesting thing about psychedelics is that there are multiple people all over the world and in the United States that have licenses from the DEA to manufacture them for research purposes and other purposes, you know, to train dogs to detect them, to develop urine tests and other drug detection tests. But there's a lot of people that have licenses to synthesize Schedule I illegal psychedelics. In contrast, the medical use of marijuana is monopolized by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So if you want to look at the beneficial uses of marijuana, there's only one place that you can get a legal supply of marijuana, and that's from the government agency whose mission is to determine what's wrong with marijuana and to justify the drug war. I mean, NIDA's mission did not used to be, you know, justify the drug war. It was more of a pure science organization, but that got perverted over the years by various directors who felt that by pandering to Congress and producing slanted research and only looking to exaggerate benefits, that they could end up increasing their budget.
You mean exaggerating
a bigger organization?
Exaggerating harms, you mean?
What did I say?
You said exaggerating benefits.
Ah. Oh my God. Sorry. Yes. You're totally right. Okay. All right. Well, what the story is, though, is that the National Institute on Drug Abuse has the monopoly on the source of marijuana that can be used in research. And their mission is not to develop the medical use of marijuana. And they are associated with the policymakers and the DEA that are focused on supporting the drug war. And so in order to do research with marijuana into the benefits, into making marijuana into a medicine, it's fundamentally obstructed by the National Institute on Drug Abuse monopoly on the supply of marijuana. And MAPS has had two studies approved by the FDA and by institutional review boards that review the safety to the human subjects, that we were unable to get marijuana to do the studies. One was marijuana for AIDS wasting in the early 90s. The other was marijuana for migraine. So it was, and also now we have been trying for over 5 years to buy 10 grams of marijuana for marijuana vaporizer research that isn't even involving humans. We're just trying to figure out what is in the vapor produced by these marijuana vaporizers. And the issue is that when you vaporize marijuana, you don't burn it. You get a steam that comes off of it, and there are no products of combustion. So from a safety point of view, the FDA is quite likely to look at the risk-benefit ratio of vaporized marijuana and say, yeah, this makes it. You can make this into a medicine. And the National Institute on Drug Abuse realizes that, and so they won't even sell us 10 grams for over 5 years. So because we had two projects blocked by NIDA, I recognized that we needed to break the government monopoly. So in 2001, from 2000 to 2001, I spent a year looking for you know, the marijuana's version of Rosa Parks. I wanted somebody for a test case that would apply to the government to get a license to grow marijuana. And I figured I needed somebody that was not connected in any way with marijuana legalization, somebody that was very well known for their work with medicinal plants, probably at an academic institution, since the University of Mississippi is where NIDA has its marijuana grown, and that would be in an academic context. And I needed a senior professor who was tenured, who could withstand any kind of political pressure and not have his or her job at risk for their work. And so I spent about a year trying to figure out, find somebody like this. And I ended up finding, getting linked to Professor Lyle Craker at UMass Amherst, who was the head of the medicinal plant program at the Department of Plant and Soil and Insect Sciences, and who was editor of several journals on plant medicines, and perfect. And he had nothing to do with the legalization of marijuana movement. He just felt that plants should be researched for the medicinal properties. So in 2001, he applied for a license to DEA in order to grow marijuana under MAP sponsorship to be used only in federally approved research. So we have 13 states now that have approved medical marijuana, but they're not really accepted by the federal government. So the whole idea was that this would not be to provide marijuana to people in states that have approved marijuana. This is only for federal research, only for DEA and FDA approved research. And that would be what the purpose of this would be. So we applied in 2001, and all sorts of things happened. DEA lost the license, lost the application, supposedly. A lot of pathetic things happened. They claimed to have lost the license. We figured that out like after about 6 months. They claimed to have lost the license. I was inquiring what's going on. So then we, fortunately, the University of Massachusetts at Amherst is a bureaucracy, and they keep copies of everything, so they resubmitted the license application. So then we wait a month, wait 2 months, and then it turns out, oh, they don't accept the application because it was a photocopy of the signature. It wasn't an original signature. I'm like, well, that's pretty creative. So on and on and on and on. And eventually, 3.5 years go by, and nothing happens. So we sue the DEA with some great pro bono lawyers in Washington, D.C., for unreasonable delay under the Administrative Procedures Act. And the DEA finally, rather than trying to justify, the court said that it wasn't clear that doing nothing for 3.5 years was unreasonable delay, but the DEA would have to at least explain why it was that they had done nothing. So rather than do that, DEA rejected the application. So that was great, actually. So getting the DEA to say no was a major victory, because then we could argue on the merits of why they said no. So then we sued in a DEA administrative law judge court, just the same kind of court as we had sued before when the DEA wanted to criminalize MDMA. And that led to a whole series of hearings and everything like that, and we had about $250,000 worth of pro bono legal services from Julie Carpenter at the big D.C. law firm. She just did great. We had the ACLU, Drug Law Reform Project, and we ended up on around February 12, 2007, the DEA administrative law judge said that we won the application. We won the case, and she recommended to hold on a second. I need like an understanding. Okay, sorry. So we ended up February 12, 2007, the DEA administrative law judge ruled in our favor and recommended to the DEA that Professor Lyle Craker receive a license, and that it was in the public interest for the government monopoly to end on the production of marijuana for legal research. And there's a lot of different reasons why no pharmaceutical company could ever dream of making marijuana into a medicine with a government supply. It's so arbitrary whether you get permission for research. You have to currently get permission from FDA, and then you have to get permission from NIDA, and they can sit there forever. There is no, like I said, 5 years trying to get 10 grams. You can't plan. You're not going to spend millions of dollars on research when you don't know if you're ever able to do your next study, because they might just stonewall you forever. Also, you're only supposed to do research in a drug that you want to market. I mean, that's obvious. I want to do research in MDMA because we want to make MDMA into prescription medicine. But with plant medicines, they're all unique. It's not clear if one strain is equivalent to the other. You should be able to do research in the strain that you want to be approved. And NIDA can grow marijuana for research, but they're not permitted to grow for prescription use. And the person that's growing it, Professor El Soli, is just rife with conflict of interest. He's making loads of money. He's got licenses to, he's developed a marijuana suppository that he thinks, a THC suppository. He thinks he's got some chance in having people take that as a medicine, which is extremely unlikely. But then he got a license to grow large amounts of marijuana and then extract the THC to make a generic version of oral THC, which is a prescription medicine. It was made a prescription medicine in 85, primarily in order to stop the smoked marijuana from ever becoming a medicine. Incidentally, the DEA said that such licenses were against our international treaty obligations. That was something they used against us for a couple years. But then they gave the exact kind of license to Professor El Soli to grow. So he's got millions of conflict of interest, major sort. So since February of 2007, we've gotten 45 members of Congress to write a letter to DEA saying give the license. Two U.S. senators, Senators Kennedy and Kerry, have written letters, both to the DEA, saying, you know, give the license to Professor Craker. And DEA's preferred strategy is a strategy of delay. And that's what they've done since the early 1970s, when the first studies were done on marijuana for nausea control for cancer chemotherapy. And the DEA said, no, we can't make this into a medicine. The research was blocked. It became illegal. Then late 70s, early 80s, a bunch of state studies were done. And they showed that in some significant percentage of patients, smoked marijuana worked way better than the oral THC pill. So it's just been a really frustrating situation. But DEA has delayed almost a year, 9 months now, and have done nothing. So what we're hoping is that the Obama administration will come through and say science is more important than politics when it comes to medical marijuana research. You know, in this 2008 election, there was a medical marijuana initiative in Michigan. It got more votes than Obama did. There was a marijuana decrim initiative in Massachusetts. It got more votes than Obama did. On the other hand, Rahm Emanuel, who is the chief of staff, took a very aggressive stance under Clinton in 1996 when California passed the Prop 215 that started the whole medical marijuana situation, and Arizona passed Prop 200.
I was a part of passing that, actually.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, so Rahm Emanuel was part of the Clinton administration response trying to threaten doctors with jail and losing their license if they were to recommend marijuana to their patients. That later, Conant versus the administration, various administration officials, went to the Supreme Court, and they decided that there was the legal right for doctors to recommend marijuana to their patients if they thought that was their best medical judgment. So we've got an uncertain situation right now. At some point, DEA is going to have to respond to the recommendation of the administrative law judge with a final ruling. And what that response will be, we don't know. If they reject it, they're going to be sued again, but then they win by delay, but they lose by destroying their credibility and more states will defect from this whole idea that it even has to be evaluated by FDA. So we're actually the conservative wing of the medical marijuana movement, and we're saying, hey, let's do the studies. Let the science tell the story. And everybody else is saying, the science is so blocked that we need to revolt, forget about the FDA, and have states declare through political means that marijuana can be a legal medicine. I support those efforts because they're right. The FDA route is completely blocked. So we did win a victory in our lawsuit against DEA. We're still haven't won the war. The war will be where they say, okay, science first, and then however that turns out is however that turns out. That will be a challenge. We'll have to raise millions and millions of dollars, and it'll take us probably a decade to do all the studies and get the FDA to review the data. But I think that eventually marijuana will become a prescription medicine, either smoked or vaporized. Ironically, one of the government's major, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, a major researcher on marijuana lung function, Dr. Donald Tashkin, has found that marijuana is not linked to lung cancer. So all of the DARE materials, all of the stuff about how marijuana linked to cancer, more and more we're learning about the anti-tumor properties of the cannabinoids. So I believe that smoked marijuana can make it into a medicine. I believe even more so that vaporized marijuana can make it into a medicine, and that's why the government is trying to block research into vaporizers, because they know it changes the risk-benefit ratio. But the government has shifted, and it's a new administration coming up, and we're hoping for the best. We're hoping that they will not pander to the drug warriors, that Rahm Emanuel has wised up and changed his mind and decides that science is really more important than, you know, looking tough on drugs. I mean, that was before when he was working for Clinton, who sort of caught himself by saying that he smoked pot, but he really didn't inhale. When Barack Obama was asked the same question, he said he smoked pot and he did inhale, and he thought that was the point. So he's not as needing to be as defensive about things, but he is going to be a centrist. So we don't know what's going to happen as far as medical marijuana, but we do know that more and more states are going to defect from the whole idea of FDA evaluating marijuana as medicine if their FDA's process is blocked. Not the FDA is willing to have research be done. It's the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the DEA, and the drug czar who have conspired to block medical marijuana research. And hopefully that will change maybe in the first 6 months or so of the Obama administration.
I heard you were just approved for LSD studies?
A while ago.
Well, yeah, what, 2 or 3 months ago maybe?
Well, no, actually. Well, tell me what you heard. Maybe you're thinking of Amanda and the Beckley Foundation?
Yeah, I'd seen something on your website or gotten an email recently from MAPS that was discussing that. Maybe I misread what it was saying.
Oh, if it was from us, no, then it was definitely us. Yeah, what has happened is that the LSD we got approved before Albert Hofmann died, before Albert and Anita died. So it was in December of last year, and that was what was so good about it. And then we've already had several people treated in the LSD study.
Wow. And yeah. How is that study going? What are your plans for the study?
Well, it's looking at anxiety associated with end-of-life issues.
So it's comparable to Dr. Grobe's study?
Yeah, actually quite. I mean, it's 12 persons, very similar. And so we're just trying LSD instead of psilocybin.
Interesting. So what do you hope to find with that?
Well, because we have limited resources, we're having to do some sort of conceptual leaps. So we have a study at Harvard, which is MDMA for advanced stage cancer patients. We're going to start our own study for psilocybin for advanced stage cancer patients with anxiety. and this particular one with LSD, so that there's several different variables going on here in these different studies. One, the primary ones are the drug, and then also the co-therapist team. So what we're trying to see is if we can figure out from these three different studies, all small, if we can somehow or other look beyond the therapist variable and figure out if there even is one of those drugs that's better than the others for cancer patients, for people with anxiety associated with end-of-life issues. Because we're not going to do, millions of dollars worth of research into MDMA to make it for anxiety, millions of dollars worth of research with LSD to make it for anxiety with end-of-life issues, and, yet more millions with psilocybin. Now, it may also turn out that what we really are working towards is psychedelic psychotherapy, not just one drug as the best drug for something. So that what it is likely to move towards eventually is for somebody that has anxiety associated with end-of-life issues, that they may begin with MDMA, let's say, or they may begin with ketamine. Then they may move to a psilocybin. Then they may move, of course, depends on how much time they have to live and how valuable these sessions are turning out to be and how deep is their anxiety, things like that. But that there may be a process that people move through, a process of psychedelic psychotherapy that involves different drugs at different times and different sequences based on clinical judgment and also the kind of prior experience of the subjects and the inclination of the subjects. So I think what we're looking towards with these particular studies that we're doing is, in the minimum amount of money, gather early information. Now, there's been one subject only in the U.S. MDMA cancer anxiety study at Harvard. That subject has done so well that it's tremendous. So that we, you don't want to make big decisions on the basis of, one subject, but we do have a one data point that is so compelling, this man's story, that there's strong evidence that MDMA is a really great drug to use to work with people who are facing end-of-life issues. Now, what's going to happen as far as psilocybin stuff? There's clearly value in psilocybin as well. But, from a sort of efficiency perspective, what we're hoping to do, as I said, is to do studies in one study in LSD, one in MDMA, one in psilocybin, and then see if we can guess or get a feel for which is the one that we would most like to move forward with into larger scale studies. Now, the actual original idea for MAPS when we started years ago was that we would have one series of studies with MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder and one series of studies with these different psychedelics for anxiety associated with end-of-life issues, and that they would all ideally get done around the same time. And then what we would do is we would figure out from that which was the best psychedelic drug and the best clinical condition to move forward into these large-scale phase 3 studies, because this was sort of based on being the maximum efficiency with the least amount of money. Now, our MDMA stuff has gone forward faster than the end-of-life things have gone. And what we've found is the results are so positive that there is no reason to kind of wait for this comparison with the end-of-life research, which is lagging probably a year or so behind the MDMA PTSD stuff. The MDMA PTSD is so good that it makes sense to go ahead with that. So we've now focused on that as a full-time project, mainstream fast as we can, scale up, and then we will see, you know, what happens with this whole question about working with people with end of life. It's really important that we do this work at end of life because, again, we are dealing with, you know, a very scared culture and one that has been vastly misinformed about the risks of psychedelics and vastly misinformed about the supposed complete lack of benefits. So working with people who are anxious about dying, that's sort of everybody. It's not like medical marijuana for AIDS wasting, which is, you know, a drug for them. But people who are dying, that's all of us. And if we can show that we can help in that sort of core human struggle, then I think people are more willing to take a look at psychedelics. People are more scared of dying than they are of drugs.
So
if we can use drugs to help people deal with the fear of dying, then we have a good chance of integrating the use of these drugs into our culture. So we need to definitely continue with this whole effort for end of life. But I guess we're about a year or so away from the completion of the LSD project, maybe a year and a half. We're not sure with the MDMA one. We've had some issues of recruiting that are going to be addressed, hopefully, very soon. We've made it really hard on ourselves because we initially could only recruit from one oncologist who we thought and they thought would have all the patients we wanted, and it turned out not to be the case. So now we've opened it up to people within 100 miles of McLean Hospital, and things are likely to improve as far as recruitment.
Fascinating. So in the studies so far, what benefits and what dangers have been found with LSD?
Well, it's really too early to say.
What about prior studies?
We've only had a couple people. I mean, what we can say already, though, I mean, there's some limited things that we can say. We can say that so far two people, have been safely treated with LSD. Now, by LSD, I mean 200 micrograms of LSD is the full dose, and the placebo is 20 micrograms. So the placebo dose is barely noticeable. 200 micrograms is substantial. I argued for a higher dose of around 250 micrograms. That's what Albert Hoffman took on his first inadvertent LSD experience. But 200 is still substantial. And so far, we've been able to it's randomized, so we're not 100% sure exactly what people have gotten, but it does seem like we've been able to do this safely. Now, that's only, again, two people. So we've got a lot more to learn. And one of the key issues for us, and this is why the end-of-life studies are sort of lagging, one of the reasons why they're lagging behind the PTSD, is that it's not exactly clear that the kind of existential changes that people make facing death under the influence of psychedelics, where they become, in many cases, a psychedelic mystical experience, will help them to lose a certain amount of fear of death, focus more on the present moments that they have while they're alive rather than constantly thinking about the times they're not going to have, that there's a whole lot of benefits, but whether those map out in terms of reductions of anxiety on the anxiety measures is not exactly clear. So that is our core concern. With MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder, it's simple. There is a worldwide accepted measure for PTSD that's translated into numerous languages, the clinician-administered PTSD scale, or the CAPS, and that is really directly related to the underlying problems that people have with PTSD. So we have a measure that will be accepted by the regulatory agencies that tracks with the kind of therapy that we're doing. With the end-of-life stuff, it's not clear yet that these measures that we have, which are the standard anxiety measures accepted by FDA for making other drugs approved as anti-anxiety or anti-depression medicines, whether the kind of psychedelic psychotherapy changes that will be produced will map onto these measures. So that's one of the points of these phase two studies, is you look at you refine your measures, your treatment method, your choice of patients, your doses, and you gather safety information. So that's where we're going to be for the next couple years with end-of-life research. With the PTSD, we're also going to be there probably for another couple years, but we're already know that we've got the measure. We believe that we have our method more or less in terms of three doses of 125 milligrams followed 1.5 to 2.5 hours later by a supplemental dose of half the initial dose, so 62.5 to prolong the plateau, that we're going to be looking our vets different than people who have PTSD from sexual assault. So we have a series of questions, still in need of being addressed, but we're much closer and tuned in, and we already have our first pilot study that was a tremendous success that CNN just did a great report on. Dr. Sanjay Gupta talked about it. So that we're substantially further ahead with MDMA for PTSD. But, again, we've got our work cut out for us for the next decade or two. There's a lot of different drugs, a lot of different uses. One of the uses that's terrific that we've not really spoken about is MDMA for couples therapy. But having a bad relationship is not necessarily a disease as the FDA looks at it. So getting approval for a psychedelic, in the face of the war on drugs, we really have to focus on treating diseases so that we have sort of the approach that looks most like pharmaceutical drug development. But eventually, I think there'll be, MDMA therapy for, couples, marital therapy. But that will follow because that's not directly the, treating a disease. So it's complicated, but there's all sorts of political and practical issues that we have to address while we're trying to do all this research.
Could you tell me about prior studies, like with Dr. Stanislav Grof?
Well, yes, I can. Stan is the sort of world's leading LSD researcher, more experienced than anybody else. He's done more of the integrative intellectual work with the structure of the unconscious. So he's just done fantastic work. And he's been the mentor and the inspiration for the whole psychedelic renaissance. If not for him, it wouldn't be we wouldn't be around doing what we're doing in the way that we're doing it. Now, there have been thousands of studies from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. The last psychedelic research was really ended in 71, therapeutic studies is ended in 71. That's what makes our study with MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder so groundbreaking. There have been some studies that were done in Russia with ketamine for heroin addiction, alcoholism, and those studies were terrific. Those were done in the 80s and 90s. And early 2000, but have also been shut down now, unfortunately, by the Russian government in a classic heavy-handed approach whereby when a drug becomes used in a non-medical setting, then they shut down even the medical use, so that there is no, you know, methadone, for example, in Russia. But Stan's work stands out because he really had great experimental method, and he also sort of led the way into the work with psychedelics for end of life. Now, there was work that was started in the 1960s, late 50s, by Eric Cast in Chicago. That was LSD for people with cancer, but it was in large part looking at pain, and they did look at some psychological stuff as well. That research was great. And then, really, Walter Pahnke, who did the Good Friday Experiment, and Stan sort of pioneered the work with LSD with cancer patients in the psychotherapeutic approach, more so than Eric Cast. And that research was great and has very promising, but shut down prematurely. Stan also did excellent work with LSD with alcoholics and heroin addicts. And so what we have is these tantalizing gems of research in the scientific literature that have been squashed prematurely as a result of this social backlash that took place against sort of the turmoil of the psychedelic 60s. And Stan, in a brilliant maneuver, figured out that through hyperventilation that it was possible to produce a lot of the same kind of experiences that had been produced before with LSD. And so he proceeded to develop that through the 70s and 80s and 90s, and he's trained loads of people in holotropic breathwork, including myself and Michael Midhofer, who's doing our MDMA PTSD study, has been trained in the holotropic breathwork, a lot of people. And what we're trying to do is to take those leads that he had helped pioneer and bring them into the kind of scientific studies that the FDA will accept as reliable data for the argument that these drugs should be made into prescription medicines. So what we're doing is, standing on the shoulders of giants, as the expression goes, and really trying to further validate what Stan did. Now, in his work, there was, in general, we're all a product of our times, and there was this hope that psychedelics were a one-dose miracle cure. And so the work with alcoholics and heroin addicts that Stan was involved with, their model was a large, high-dose psychedelic experience to sort of help people hit bottom, go through all the denial, acknowledge all the stuff that they had been trying to deny about the consequences of their addiction, and then move deeper into that, into the sort of transpersonal realms, where people would have this psychedelic mystical experience, which would then act as an inspiration and a source of strength to motivate them for a different kind of a lifestyle. And that actually is a lot about what you see in traditional AA. It's a lot about surrendering to higher power and spiritual experiences. And, Bill W. tried LSD and thought it could be really helpful in the treatment of alcoholics. He did it in the 50s with Betty Eisner and Sidney Cohn as his sitters. He's written about it in the Bible of the AA movement, Pass It On, the story of Bill Wilson and how the AA message reached the world. So if you go into that, you will get that book from AA, Pass It On, and you'll find out that Bill Wilson took LSD and thought it had good potential. However, that was a little bit too controversial for the AA people, and he ended up withdrawing from AA his involvement. He also didn't want to build this kind of cult of personality. But the sort of one-dose miracle cure is something that we really no longer speak of. It's clear that we need, for PTSD, we're talking about three sessions, a three-session model. There are some people in whom one experience with LSD will change them around from being alcoholics. So it's not untrue that sometimes one experience will do it. It's just rare, and also there needs to be this sort of focus on integration, and people develop a therapeutic alliance with the therapist. What we've found in the MDMA PTSD study is that people seem to do better on the second experience than the first. And, they've developed a certain capacity to navigate in the altered states. They understand what's going to happen to them. They trust the therapists and they trust themselves. And so people tend to make more progress. What we've got is, I would say, slight modifications of the design. I mean, Stan's work with cancer patients was also great, but it was also mostly in this one-session model. So we've got a two-session model because, we're working with people that don't have much time to live, advanced stage cancer patients. But we're moving into a two-session model, sometimes perhaps even a three-session model if we can work with people who are not quite so close to death's door.
It almost sounds like what you're doing is what Terence McKenna used to talk about, using psychedelics to practice for death before death.
Yeah, very much, very much.
Interesting.
There's a letting go. I mean, what I would say the biggest, Stan had a saying, he who dies before he dies doesn't die when he dies. And that's some saying from thousands of years ago. But this idea that if you can go through ego death while you're alive, that the bodily death is something that you won't be so scared of, and that the ego death and body death that happen together at the end of life is something that if you open to, you'll get a lot more out of it, and you will really make those passing days much easier. And also, if you can go through this ego death at an early age, then you have less fear of the actual death, and so your whole life can be enhanced as a result of this sort of deeper understanding of the role of death. And that's where we hope that these drugs will be eventually used in rites of passage rituals at different stages of life, so that people can keep reinventing themselves. That's supposedly one of the hallmarks of Western capitalism, is that people can change jobs and market forces, and you can reinvent yourself. So that involves a certain sort of ego death, like who do you think you are, and who can you be, and what is your potential? And so that this process of ego death, I think, is really important, even in small ways where people can handle more criticism, self-criticism, or other people's criticism, because they're not so attached to this fragile ego that they can, grow and incorporate larger views of themselves. So that if you can do this ego death, you can sort of keep growing as a person throughout the whole of your life.
Could you talk about what you think about Dr. Timothy Leary's research and what you feel he contributed versus the negative impact he had on the field?
Well, okay, what you just said is, what do I think about Timothy Leary's research? So we should distinguish to say that he's done some research, but of course there's an awful lot of things that he's done that are not research-oriented, that are more, cultural change kind of efforts. And his research really, with psychedelics, began around 1960, ended around 1963 when he got kicked out of Harvard. And if you look at the research, what he did was sort of just a initial naturalistic study with psilocybin, where he gave it to a bunch of people and just sort of described what it did. And that was really good. I think that he ended up learning a lot about it, and out of that started coming this core idea that we still see today as a core idea, this idea of set and setting, that the experience is influenced by the person's mental set as they go into the experience and the setting in which they did it. So your intentions and your context influence the outcome of the experience. So that came in part from his naturalistic study, and you know, he started the Harvard Psilocybin Project, and so that part's good. Then there was two studies only that really came out of his work. He did nothing with LSD. So there's no LSD research that Tim Leary was involved in. You could say that maybe he did another naturalistic study. Sorry, I have to get my other line. You can stop right there. I'll be right back. Okay, sorry. All right, so what I was saying is that, you know, maybe, you know, you could say that Tim did a naturalistic study with LSD, but there's not anything really that survives, you know, where he, about that. And so I think really his work was with psilocybin at Harvard. LSD came on the scene a little bit later, and it added to the controversy, and it was what he was primarily associated with post-Harvard. But his research really focused on two different studies. One is the Good Friday experiment that Walter Pahnke, who was his PhD student, conducted, and Tim was the faculty sponsor. And then the other was the Concord Prison experiment. And I've done long-term follow-up studies to both of them. So I've spent a lot of time sort of following the footsteps of Tim Leary. And his first study has inspired many, many people. The Good Friday experiment was phenomenal in terms of the scientific methodology, the complexity of the study, the attempt to really look at objectively whether psychedelic drugs can catalyze mystical experience. And his research was replicated in part, you know, 45 years later by Roland Griffiths from Johns Hopkins, who has recently published a paper on psilocybin and mystical experiences. I say replicated in part because Roland's work was individuals getting psilocybin in a clinical research context one at a time, and Tim's Good Friday experiment was group setting in church on Good Friday, 20 subjects, 10 got placebo, 10 got psilocybin. The minister was Reverend Howard Thurman, who was Martin Luther King's mentor. Martin Luther King got his PhD at Boston University, and Reverend Howard Thurman was the minister at Boston University. And in 1962, psychedelics were not so controversial. He permitted people to go into a basement chapel during his Good Friday service, 3.5-hour service, and he permitted them to do this experiment where 20 people took pills, half psilocybin, half placebo. And after the service, there was questionnaires that were administered that were designed to measure the depth of sort of a classic mystical experience. And by mystical spiritual, what they did was they took it out of a specific religious context. So they tried to think about, you know, in their mind, what is the core religious experience that is shared by all? And if there is such a thing, I mean, this is, of course, very controversial with all the fundamentalists of every religion who say that they've got the only one right way and that, you know, if you don't do it through their symbol systems, it's not real, or it's a delusion, or worse, you know, the devil's, you know. But other people are believing that there is a sort of core mystical experience, and this questionnaire was designed to evaluate that. And then at 6 months, Walter Pahnke gave a questionnaire again to administer to people about long-term beneficial changes or harmful changes, what they had to say about it.
Wasn't
so
it... I was just going to ask, wasn't it Dr. Leary who said that LSD has the ability to cause psychosis in people who have never taken it?
Yes.
And that would be a perfect example of just that.
Well, he was commenting on, you know, sort of the cultural hysteria.
Well, but in a way, people's reaction to it through a religious perspective is very similar. You know, that they've got the only way, and that any other way is of the devil, and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, so, I mean, Tim was a comedian. Tim was really sharp, really funny, very focused on, you know, people making their own decisions, very anti-authoritarian. And so the Good Friday Experiment was demonstrated that 9 out of the 20 people had a substantial mystical experience, according to the questionnaire, and 8 out of those 9 had the psilocybin. So, and at 6 months, people reported beneficial experiences, beneficial changes. So it's tremendous. It's absolutely tremendous study. And during the 80s, when it was impossible to get permission to do psychedelic research where you actually administer psychedelics, I wanted to do a study, and so I decided to do a follow-up to the Good Friday Experiment, and that proved to be one of the turning points of my lives and one of the, you know, few, you know, great ideas I've had. And so I tracked these people down, you know, 25 years later, plus, and I identified 19 out of the 20 and found that they considered it to have been, in retrospect, still a valid mystical experience, those that had had one before. And it had opened the door to subsequent mystical experiences, which they generally preferred, the non-drug ones. The drug ones were oscillating between fear, terror, fear of going crazy, fear of dying, and these beautiful, blissful moments of connection and unity. Very intense. Their non-drug experiences tended to be more peaceful, more not so much up and down like that, but walking in nature or a whole range of catalysts for it, but more uniformly positive. And that there was just this sense from the long-term follow-up that was so important for me, is that this classic mystical experience had certain fruits in the lives of these people. And that's sort of the mystical test, is, you know, the fruits test. You know, by their fruits ye shall know them, said Jesus. And so, you know, this experience had these positive fruits. And people talked about how they had this sense of connection, they had a different view of death, they were less scared of death, they were less scared of political pressure, in a sense. And so they felt that this mystical experience led them into more involvement with the struggles of the day. Also less, let's just, you know, bide our time and, you know, our reward is in heaven, to, you know, we need to build the heaven on earth. And so there was this movement into the civil rights movement, into the anti-war movement, into the environmental movement, into the women's movement, into the gay rights movement, that these people in the Good Friday Experiment helped me see the key to the 60s, which was that part of the turmoil and the backlash was due to when psychedelics go wrong, when people are not prepared and they have destructive experiences, sometimes ending in their deaths, either through suicide or, you know, sloppy driving or through different tragedies, but that the backlash was even more due to the fact that psychedelics, when they go right, can inspire people to be more progressive and more focused on social justice in this world. Now, what I did discover, and this gets back to your question a long time ago of what do I think about Tim Leary's research, is that there was a cover-up, which shocked me to find out, and that was that one of the people in the Good Friday Experiment, who got so carried away by the sermon about how you tell people that there's a man on the cross, that he ended up leaving the chapel and decided he had to tell somebody this man on the cross, and he went out of the chapel and went roaming down the road. Commonwealth Ave is right in front of Boston University and Marsh Chapel, where the experiment took place, really dangerous, and Tim Leary had to go chase him down, and he felt he was, like, at risk of getting hit by a car, and he should go back into the chapel. He didn't want to do it, and they gave him a shot of Thorazine. So they actually tranquilized somebody during this experiment, but they hid it. Nobody ever knew it. So So sadly, here I was discovering that there was this cover-up to this great experiment. So the risks of these drugs were underplayed by Tim in his experiment. Walter Pankey, also guilty of the same thing, did not really mention it. But you can see that there's growing social conflict, and they probably felt, you know, better not to mention it. But that's not science. Science, you're supposed to mention everything. So I felt in core, the results of the experiment and their interpretation of them were confirmed by the long-term follow-up. Psychedelics really did, according to these people, produce genuine mystical experiences that had long-term positive beneficial consequences in their lives. But the risks were underplayed by the virtue of this fact getting this person getting Thorazine and that not being revealed. So I felt that Tim's experiment was great, but that there was a little bit of an ethical breach there.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Do you believe that the experience occasioned by these substances is real, such as Benny Shannon proposes in Antipodes of the Mind, or is it just a chemical reaction in the brain?
Well, I think that there's not a clear distinction between those two. I mean, what is the difference? Can something be real and also a chemical experience in the brain? Isn't everything a chemical experience in the brain? You know, don't you have chemical changes in the brain when you fall in love? So I think that, you know, the answer is, I guess, or a better way to maybe phrase the question is, you know, is this a delusion? You know, is this genuine spirituality? And, you know, is it a hallucination, which is what the government calls these drugs, hallucinogenic drugs? These people who were in the study were divinity students. So they're presumably trying to figure out what is the reality beneath the reality. And they felt that it was genuine. And they felt that it had positive consequences. And, you know, the mystical literature has the fruits test. W.T. Stace was one of the scholars of religion from which his categories of mystical experience are in large part what Walter Pankey based his questionnaire on. And he had what's called the theory of causal indifference, which means that the cause of this mystical experience is not how you can evaluate it. There are people who are into S&M and they claim, you know, spiritual experiences. There, you can go back to the monks who flagellate themselves. You know, there are people who have it in sex. There are people who have it, the road to Damascus. You know, people are on the way to do horrible things and they get this kind of inspiration and they, you know, Paul on the road to Damascus, you know, so that you can have a mystical experience. You do not evaluate it, the validity of it, the truth of it, the reality of it is not based on the cause, but it's based on the experience itself, and then even more so on the fruits of that experience. So based on this Good Friday follow-up, these people described enormous importance to their own lives, these fruits from that experience. And they considered it valid, and they had non-drug experiences, many of them, after the drug experiences with which to compare and contrast. So I think we can say on the basis of that research that it was real.
Is there...
Now...
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, Tim's other... To continue to try to respond to your first question about what do I think of Tim, you know, to complete it, his other experiment was the Concord Prison Experiment. And there he was looking at objective criteria for behavior change. He said, you know, it's awful difficult to get everybody to agree, just as you just asked. You know, was it a real experience? Was it not? Was it a fake experience? Was it a delusion? And he's like, well, who cares? You know, if we can find some situation where people have a psychedelic experience, and if there's a clear change in their behavior to the benefit, then we can say, hey, that was a good experiment and a good use of the drug and beneficial use of the drug. And so what he felt was, if you can take a bunch of prisoners who are about to be released from prison, and before they are released, you give them some psychedelic experiences, psilocybin experiences in the prison as part of their therapy, that then you can see if they stay out of prison, more so than the people that didn't. So that was the basis of the Concord Prison Experiment, was therapy sessions, several therapy sessions with people inside the prison taking psilocybin. And what he claimed was that it worked, that the group of people that got psilocybin stayed out of prison much longer at much higher rate than the base rate of people from that same prison who had been released right before that. And so this was considered to be one of the best examples of psychedelic psychotherapy in the psychedelic literature. And Tim certainly presented it that way, and so the Concord Prison Experiment was a fantastic success. And so everybody believed. And there was an article published in the Boston Globe about the Good Friday Experiment follow-up that I did. And then someone called me from the Department of Corrections and said that they had an interesting offer for me. Would I want to do a follow-up to the Concord Prison Experiment? And I'm like, God, I'd love to, but there's no information about who these prisoners were. And he said, well, that's solved because we've kept the list. And they had files on everybody who was in the Concord Prison Experiment, and he said they kept these files on all their interesting prisoners, Malcolm X, and they had a bunch of stuff. And he could provide me access if I wanted to do a follow-up. And so I said, sure, I would love to. It took us a year to get permission. It went all the way up to Governor Weld, who was the governor at the time. And the actual approval came down from the governor's office with a handwritten note on the letter giving us approval that said, no drug administration. So, of course we were not talking about giving psilocybin to anybody, but they just wanted to make clear that we weren't. But the more that I did research into it, the more I couldn't figure it out. The recidivism rates weren't matching up to what Tim had claimed they were. And, sadly, I discovered that he had committed scientific fraud and that the experiment had not worked. And I figured out how he justified it, and I figured out his alternative counting rules, and he basically had initially compared the base rate of people who'd been out of prison for 2 years on average with the people in his study who'd been out of prison for 10 months on average. So just naturally, if you do a study and you look at people the day after they're released from prison, you'll probably have a 0% recidivism rate. And if you wait another day, probably it's still the same. But if you wait another year, some of them will have had a chance to do things and get them in trouble. And so the longer you look after somebody's been in prison, you would guess that the higher the recidivism rate would be. So he compared his group of people at an average of 10 months out of prison with the group of the base rate, which had been out of prison an average of 24 months. So I had to figure out what to do, and I had to decide, should I do nothing and just let everybody think it was a great experiment? And I felt that would be inappropriate, unfortunately. So I published my results and discredited what at the time had been one of the foremost examples of the benefits of psychedelic psychotherapy. And it also put me a little bit into a situation of criticizing Tim, and so it was difficult. But, that later bought me a certain amount of credibility, so that when we tried to start psychedelic research at Harvard, they saw that I was more committed to the data than I was committed to proving that psychedelics were great, and that I wasn't going to act like Timothy Leary. So, the ghost of Timothy Leary haunts the halls of Harvard and still does, and they're very concerned about how they're perceived. But
was there any overall benefit in the study shown?
No.
Interesting.
No. What had happened was that, again, I talked earlier about this one-dose miracle cure model. What happened is that as the study was going along, Tim and others, Ralph Messner, they realized that once people are let out of prison, you need support groups. It's like halfway houses. You need support. You can't do it all in this altered state. And just as they were figuring it out, they started to assemble the support group of the prisoners. But that's when the controversy got so great about everything that Tim was doing that he got kicked out of Harvard. So that I think that he would have done a lot more for these prisoners with the support. And if you can combine experiences where people go through the denial, come to terms with what they did, get inspired by sort of this connection, sense of connection and pro-social behaviors, that you will, if you support that with aftercare, I think psychedelics can play a major role in reducing recidivism. But it's part of a bigger package. And Tim was not able to really create that bigger package because he got kicked out of Harvard and things started falling apart. So that I think later on, even though he knew the experiment hadn't worked, he said that it did because he saw so much negative propaganda about psychedelics that was wrong and false and intentionally so. I think he must have thought, I'll just lie on the other side because everybody's lying here. And his lie was kind of, in his mind, closer to the truth that, yes, psychedelics had a lot of potential. Now, you know, I did figure this out shortly before he died, and a couple weeks before he died, I took two prisoners from the Concord Prison Experiment with me, one of whom had gone back to jail and one of whom had not, and we went out and spent some time with him and had a really nice time and reminisced. And, in one of the sort of moments of my life that I'll always regret, I really didn't ask him, you know, why he falsified the data. I figured here he's about to die, and but now I realize he would have been fine if I would have said it, and he would have either explained it or laughed it off or something. But I just didn't have it in me to
call him
really
out,
confront him in that way.
I too went to a party in 94 at his house just before he died, and he was in a weak state at that time, so I understand.
Yeah. But I've been inspired by both of them. I mean, the courage to do psilocybin in prison with prisoners, it's fantastic. The Concord Prison Experiment is still a fantastic study. Bold, courageous, brilliant in its design and its attempts. And it really showed the way that, you work on these powerful experiences and then you build the support team afterwards to help with the integration. And so I think his contribution was great. As far as, whether he ended up being responsible for the research being shut down, I do fault him for, when you're talking about politics, that's a different world. When you talk about research, you should really be true to the data. But I've been more inspired than anything by his work.
There's been a subject of interest for me that I have felt needed to be studied for some time, and that is looking at the potential of various entheogens to produce violence, such as is claimed with the Berserker Rage theme and Amanita muscaria. Has anybody considered ever doing a study of that sort?
Of course not. Why would anybody want to do a study on, certainly none of the advocates of psychedelic therapy are going to say, yeah, let's see if we can produce violent behaviors. We already have alcohol. Alcohol is great at producing violent behaviors.
The story is claimed historically that Amanita muscaria is what caused the berserker violence of the Vikings, and it seems to me that a clinical study needs to be done to debunk that or to prove it, and the debate still rages on. Christian Ratch and Professor Carl Ruck are still hotly debating that even today.
Well, a study must be done. I mean, there's a lot of, you have to prioritize your limited time and who how important it is. How many people even know that, that this claim has been made? But there are psychedelic drugs, Datura, that are more delusionary, more hallucinogenic, that don't feel like there is some inherent healing property of the psyche that's been liberated that you're working with. So it's no doubt that there are drugs that make people violent or that make people confused or delusionary. And whether Amanita is one of those or not, you know, I really don't care. I mean, I don't mean to sound cold, but what I'm trying to say is that we really, you know, similarly, I don't care on which receptor sites psychedelics work on. I don't care on, you know, what brain changes happen. You know, I mean, it would be good to know all that stuff, but for what maximum leverage for minimum dollars with minimum time, I think it's better to focus on trying to show our culture that certain psychedelic drugs have beneficial uses to conditions, diseases that people in the mainstream will suffer from. And the mechanism of action of how that happens from a biochemical, neurochemical point of view, that is very important, that can follow, but that what's most missing is evidence of benefits. And then once we get that, then there'll be all sorts of people saying, okay, let's try to figure it out. You know, what's going on in the brain when that happens? And in fact, we're doing that. I mean, there's a team in Israel that wants to do functional MRI of the PTSD patients before and after MDMA treatment, but they're paying for it themselves. And they're looking for brain changes. Similarly, there's a team in Switzerland that's looking at, that we're working with, that is doing several biological measures of people with PTSD before and after MDMA therapy. They're looking at heart rate variability, the startle reflex, and EEG readings before and after. So those are good. But, you know, would I pay for them myself if I had to? No, because we don't have unlimited money. We need to bear down and focus on showing benefits. So that's why I told Amanita thing. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can be curious about, but whether they rise to the point of, you know, strategic value is a different question.
Have you looked at treating war vets for PTSD? I know there are a lot of vets out there that are interested in the MDMA and other studies for treating PTSD right now, and they've actually encouraged me to ask you that question.
Well, the answer is totally yes. And so now here we get into like the high value, high social value patient population, so that we have spent a lot of time and energy and money and effort trying to get vets in our U.S. MDMA PTSD study. We had three different teams at VAs around the country that wanted to do the research, and then they would get squashed by the higher-ups at the VA. We had to eventually, through purchasing of keywords and contacting veterans groups, Iraq War Veterans Against the War, things like that, we ended up finding two vets, and we had two vets in our study, and both of them did very well from the MDMA. And we need to show, again, that we have something to offer to the mainstream culture. And the mainstream culture now is very concerned about vets with PTSD. And we were able to show, hey, we've got something to offer. Now, we only showed it in two people. So we're thinking, actually, to design a study just for vets. It will probably just be for seven vets. Michael and Annie Mithofer will conduct it down in Charleston. And we're hoping it'll start in the early part, middle part of 2009.
Would
so
you,
yes, it's extremely important.
Would you please let me know when you start that study so that I can let people know to get in touch with you?
Yeah. Now, you know, the way that we let people know is through our monthly email updates, which are free. So anybody could go to the MAPS website, and on the upper left-hand side, you know, just put in your email address, and then you'll get our free monthly email updates.
Okay.
Or, better yet, send us some money and become a member, and you'll get our bulletin that will report on our progress. But the main thing will be through the monthly email updates, and that's the way to keep track of it. But I really appreciate that, because we really want to, once we get the study started, to enroll vets. And it is hard to recruit sometimes. so the more help we can get. But, you know, we're in, how should I put this? In the year 2004, now this is before a lot of the vets started coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq with PTSD. So 2004, the VA spent $4.3 billion on disability payments for over 215,000 vets with PTSD. So PTSD in over 215,000 vets cost the United States taxpayer $4.3 billion. And that's before a lot of these people are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq with PTSD. So from a social point of view, if MDMA-assisted psychotherapy can help some vets not develop PTSD, the economic payoff is phenomenal. Not to talk about what we owe the vets, not to talk about compassion, but just talking about it strictly in terms of economics, there's an enormous potential payoff to the United States taxpayer from any and all treatments that will help our vets not have PTSD and not require disability payments. Now, we've done our study in people that have failed on SSRI, so any medicines that's available by the pharmaceutical industry, they've tried and failed, and they've failed on psychotherapy. So that we're working with the toughest cases. In Michael and Annie's study, they had PTSD an average of 19 years. Now, most of them are not vets. Most of them are sexual assault from an early age. And people's lives are turned around. So that the economic payoff is phenomenal, the human capital payoff, the obligation of the vets, so that we definitely are trying to focus on vets with PTSD. And in Israel, our study is looking for people with war and terrorism-related PTSD.
Fascinating.
Not just, but that's you know, who we're trying to recruit. So that I think that is, for all sorts of different reasons, that they reinforce this idea that we need to develop MDMA for PTSD, and that there's the most political payoff, public support payoff, potential donations payoff. It's great.
Go ahead.
I said, and it works. That's the beauty of it all.
What studies is MAP doing with ibogaine and or ibogaine? Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Since the 80s, there's been talk about how ibogaine can help people who are addicted, particularly to opiates, go through withdrawal and start over. Now, the ibogaine movement has been like what I talked about before, this kind of one-dose miracle cure proponents. And that's, I think, a little bit, that works for many people. One dose of ibogaine works for many people. But what's frustrating is that for the last 20 years, ibogaine is illegal in the U.S., but it's legal most everywhere else in the world. And there's clinics in Mexico, in Canada, in England, in different places in Europe. And these people can run clinics legally and offer ibogaine to people. And that's been done. But there isn't a single study, prospective study, where a bunch of people were tested in terms of their addiction, and then they went through ibogaine, and then they were evaluated on a long-term basis. So there is no long-term outcome data about the effect of ibogaine on both opiate and other kind of addiction. So we've been trying to start that kind of a study, and we worked for a long time with the Iboga Therapy House in Vancouver. It was initially supported by a philanthropist who was paying for all the treatments, but then he stopped doing that. Mark Emery got into legal problems. He was a big marijuana seed exporter to the United States. And then the clinic had to shift to working on a fee-for-service basis, and the economics of that proved to be difficult for them, and the study has stopped after only recruiting 5 out of the 20 people because the clinic has now gone out of business. And our results were not great. But we've been able to switch, and now there's a clinic in Mexico run by Claire Wilkins, who's doing a great job, is also an accountant, businesswoman. And so the clinic's going to make it, I think. And so John Harrison is working on a PsyD at California Institute for Integral Studies. He's going to be evaluating these people beforehand and then once a month for a year. So this may become the first long-term outcome study with Ibogaine ever conducted. We need to raise around $30,000 for the study. That just shows you one thing, too, that budget number, which is incredibly cheap because it's only about $1,000 a subject if we can do 30 subjects for $30,000. That's because people are paying for their own treatment. All we're doing is administering questionnaires. When we have to do other kinds of studies, it can cost $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a subject because we have to pay for everything. And it's research, and you can't charge subjects. But this way is different. So we just got IRB approval, and the first subject has been enrolled in the study down in Mexico. And we hope that over the next year we'll enroll all 30 subjects and that we'll raise the $30,000. And you know, maybe in 2 years we'll be able to report our results.
What plans do you have for future studies?
Well, our future studies are really focused on developing MDMA into a prescription medicine for PTSD. That's our main thing. So we're focused on 2 years of a series of pilot studies where we look at various different doses. We try to figure out how to do a double-blind study, you know, at which doses are therapists unable to tell apart. We've got to refine our method. We're developing a treatment manual. We have to operationalize the treatment manual so that people can, independent raters can look at videotapes of people doing therapy and say, oh yeah, they're doing that method, or they're not doing your method. We have to figure out what our method is. So that we've got studies in Switzerland and Israel right now for MDMA for PTSD. Swiss study will be done in maybe about a year. The Israeli study will hopefully be done in about a year and a half. We're negotiating with the Canadian government. Well, actually, we're just about to get final approval from the Institutional Review Board. That's what I was working on this morning. And then we submit to Health Canada, see if we can get approved by Health Canada. We're trying to start a study in Jordan. That's part of our sort of world peace through psychedelics, our psychedelic diplomacy plan, and try to have the Israelis and Jordanians working together on healing the traumas of cultural conflict. And then we're trying to start a study in Spain. You know, we had our first MDMA PT study in Spain from in around 2000, and then it was shut down after only 5 people had been in it for political pressure. And so we hope to restart it in Spain. So a series of safety studies, efficacy studies, pilot studies over the next couple of years, leading to an end of phase 2 meeting with FDA. And then we design the phase 3 studies, and then those will take another 3-4 years to conduct. And so I figure that we've got 10 years, more or less, to make MDMA into a medicine. We need $10 million. If anybody who's listening to this happens to have a spare $10 million, please send it to us. or in smaller amounts, it would be fine.
I could use donations for this podcast, too, by the way.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, very important. No, but then we also want to be developing these the whole line of research into the you know, end of life, anxiety and depression associated with end of life. We'd like to start doing some research into therapeutic use of ayahuasca. So there's a lot of stuff. And I haven't even talked about our medical marijuana stuff, which is currently blocked politically. Maybe the Obama administration will decide not to be hypocritical in this respect and put science before politics. We shall see. So there's a lot of research. Right now, we've been trying for 5 years to buy 10 grams of marijuana for vaporizer research.
Yeah, you mentioned
marijuana
that.
Up at, yeah.
That's crazy.
You know, there's a lot of stuff we want to do. But I'd say, basically, it's right now, we're narrowing our focus more and more to MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, as we talked before, it'd be nice to do couples therapy with MDMA. If you could hold on a second while I get this other line.
What is your feeling of the drug war? Do you think it's helped or hurt our society?
Okay, I can be very brief on that. The drug war is a colossal failure. It's stupid. It's counterproductive. It's vengeful. It's really symbolic politics. It's nothing about ending or stopping drug abuse. And what it's about is making it's harm maximization. The drug war is a harm maximization program to make life worse for everybody that uses drugs, in the hopes that that will scare away people from using drugs. So it's ridiculous. It's putting all sorts of money into the hands of people that we don't particularly like, you know, organized crime, and, you know, plus a lot of people probably we do like, you know, a lot of independent homegrown marijuana entrepreneurs who are good people. So the drug war is a colossal failure. It's symbolic politics. We don't need it anymore. The drug war is a tool of the Republicans to win elections, because felony disenfranchisement, disproportionately, the drug war is aimed at minorities, poor, black, Hispanic, and they tend to vote more Democratic than Republican, and you arrest them for stuff, and then they can't vote anymore at all. So the drug war is a cancer on the American society and the world society. It's I'll tell you one story. Is I did a little interview at the CIA when they came recruiting at the Kennedy School when I was there. And I said, I would like to work with the CIA, and I would like to do a study of the national security implications of legalizing drugs. This was in the 80s. Reagan had declared drugs a national security threat. And I'm like, well, hey, let's just check it out. You know, what about legalizing drugs? What impact would that have on national security? Now, you know, the CIA has not got a great reputation, and they were involved with helping the Contras smuggle all sorts of cocaine into the U.S. to raise money to help fight the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and you know, whether they just turned
Iran
the
Contra
guy,
scandal and all that,
all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you could say that there are benefits to national security from keeping drugs illegal, because if you look at the Northern Alliance that helped us win the war in Afghanistan, of course now we're losing the war in Afghanistan, but for a period of time, you know, the Northern Alliance, which was our allies, made all sorts of money from opium and heroin smuggling. So you could say that, you know, there's some cases where drug money, you know, is used by our allies to do things we like, and there's other cases where it's used by people we don't like, and so we should do some benefit cost analysis. And what are the national security implications of legalizing drugs? So this guy from the CIA was like, well, you can't look at that. We can't look at that. You know, how would you like to do psychological profiles of world leaders? And I'm like, well, maybe there's other people who do that. So years later, another guy came to the Kennedy School who was in charge of the CIA's counter-narcotics division. They had, God, I don't know, 150 people working there. It was a big growth area for the CIA. And I said, has anybody done this war game-like thing? Has anybody looked at national security implications of legalizing drugs? And he's like, oh, no, we can't look at that. So we're so blind. So in any case, I believe that if you were to do that analysis, that the national security implications would be so clearly favorable to legalizing drugs. But we're always going to have a drug problem. I mean, I'm not trying to say that legalizing drugs ends the problems, but we should treat them as health problems rather than criminal justice problems. And I just realized I've gone on and on about the drug war, and I should have just said, this is a stupid idea.
What do you think is the most important aspect of your research?
The most important aspect of our research that can be done in America, even in the midst of a drug war. Oh, well, you mean by my personal research?
Yeah, just what do you think is the most important aspect of your research that you've done?
Aspect of it. It's hard for me to figure out what you're asking. The most important aspect of my research, well, I think it'll end up being, you know, showing beneficial use of MDMA, and that, you know, we've punctured the enormous hysteria over one dose permanent brain damage. That's already happened. People don't say that anymore.
Excellent.
People that do don't get that many people that believe it.
What would you like listeners of this show to go away with? If you could say something that you feel people would never forget, what would that be?
That they should go home and make a donation to MAPS. that we're only going to do it together. That this is a nonprofit. If there's a market failure, the pharmaceutical industry is not paying for these research because these drugs are not going to make them any money. They're not patentable, and they're only meant to be given a few times, and they compete against drugs that you're supposed to take every day for months or years or a lifetime. The government is not paying about it because for the stuff because they're stuck into the drug war. And the big foundations are not paying for it, the research, because that's still a little bit too controversial, although that will be changing over time. So it falls to those of us that care, and I guess I would like everybody who's listening to realize that, look at the Obama victory. He got millions of people to send small amounts of money, and he was able to beat the fundraising by the Republicans, who rely mostly on smaller amounts of people to give larger amounts of money. So, if everybody that cares a little about it gives MAPS $20 or $35, or then we'll have all that we need to do the research. So that's why I'd like listeners to
do you have
run
any...
to your computer and your credit card and send us money, which we will spend wisely, strategically, efficiently, and it'll be a good return on your investment.
And do you have anything else you would like to add to this discussion as a final statement?
That I think that one day this whole struggle will be taken for granted, and psychedelics will be available in the context of our culture, that there will be psychedelic clinics all over the place, and that that we can have a society that integrates psychedelics and their use into the core of our society, and that it's not inherently counterculture, it's not inherently so subversive, and that we'll be a healthier society that acknowledges altered states and finds a way to work with them and lets that all happen in a legal context, and that will revitalize spirituality. Different religions can use them, but there's a glorious future ahead of us, and psychedelics will be a part of it.
And we've been speaking. Go ahead.
Well, just thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome. And we've been speaking with Dr. Rick Doblin, the founder of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And Rick, would you please give everybody your website and any contact information you would like them to have for you?
The website is MAPS, MAPS.org, and there's askmaps@maps.org. Questions will come to us, and those that are sent there for me will either be answered by others if they can or sent to me. And that we really are interactive and look forward to engaging with people as much as possible.
And how do people send you donations?
Eagerly. Eagerly, gladly. But, they go to the website. You can do it electronically. MAPS is at 10424 Love Creek Road, Ben Lomond, Lomond, California, 95005. So they can mail in money or do it through the website, or donate, put us in their will. That's we have numerous people that have put us in their will. Or one person sent us remainder interest in a $1 million house that we'll get in 25 or 30 years. So there's all different ways. Where there's a will, there's a way.
That's funny. All right, Rick. Well, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your research and your lifetime of contributions to this field. And there are many people out there who appreciate what you do.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to do it. I feel it's a privilege. So I'm so grateful for all the donors to MAPS that has enabled me to have such a challenging and enjoyable and fun and satisfying job.
All right. Well, take care, and thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Sure. Okay.